Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John Edwards grew up in a Carolina mill town, made a fortune as a trial attorney, lost a son, won a U.S. Senate seat, ran for president, and came closer than you might recall in the Democratic primaries, and ran on the 2004 White House ticket with John Kerry, all before he was out of his 40s. Now John Edwards is 53. He's road-tested in presidential campaign politics, and he's back running for the U.S. presidency again in the 2008 battle. If last time he was the Democrats' smiling centrist, this time John Edwards is talking tougher as the fed-up populist. Fed up with poverty and what he calls the two Americas. Fed up with the Iraq War and saying get out. Up next on Point, a conversation with candidate for the White House, again, John Edwards. Joining me from New York, fresh off a weekend of campaigning in snowy New Hampshire, is John Edwards. Senator Edwards, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So you're back on the trail. What happened to the big smile?
It's still there.
Is it?
If you're looking hard enough, it's still there, yeah.
Okay. But there's something new going on here as well, and we want to find out all about it and hear your plans on many fronts. But let me ask you something right off the bat. You declared your candidacy in late December in New Orleans in that wiped-out Ninth Ward that we've all seen where all that poverty was exposed. And you came out of there kind of with a message that John Edwards is going to be the man of the poor in this campaign. And I want to ask you, what's your political strategy? You may be concerned about poverty, but from what I've seen, the poor do not vote in the same proportion as others. So how do you win with the strategy of being the man of the poor?
Well, first, I think it's important to recognize the difference between what I personally care about deeply and what I think the responsibilities of the president are. What I actually talked about in New Orleans was bringing people into places like New Orleans, bringing Americans into places like New Orleans, having them take responsibility, take action, and bring about the transformational change, not just that we need in this country, not just in New Orleans, but across the waterfront, whether it's climate change, the environment, health care, all the issues that America's faced with. I believe very strongly if we're going to really change things the way they need to be changed, it can't just be done from the top down. It requires the president and the engagement of the American people. That was really the message. It is true that I care deeply about the issue of poverty. I have been running a poverty center, among other things, for the last couple of years, and I will certainly talk about that in my presidential campaign. But there are huge pressing issues facing the country. As a presidential candidate and as somebody who's seasoned in presidential campaigning with some maturity on that front, I understand that the pressing issues of the day are Iraq, health care, what we're going to do about energy in this country, how we strengthen the middle class and stop this growing economic gap in America. Trust me, I understand that and understand it well.
John Edwards, how long did it take you to decide after the thumping, I guess you and John Kerry took in the last campaign, a good showing but didn't win. How long did it take you to decide you were going to go back on the trail? We read that you've been out there for a long, long time. Your turnaround was pretty quick. When did you say to yourself, I'm going back out, I'm going to run again?
I didn't really decide to actually run again until shortly before the announcement in New Orleans. Now, that doesn't mean that, again, having been through this before, that I didn't see things that needed to be done to bring about change in the country. And what I did in the interim is first, as most of the country knows, my wife Elizabeth was diagnosed with breast cancer the day after the election.
Yes.
So we spent a period of months together dealing with her health care treatment.
Mm-hmm. We've spoken to her about that. On the same day that you were all dealing with that, you and she were dealing with some very heavy news right there.
We were, but she was terrific, and we went through her chemo and her radiation treatment, and she came through it great, and she's doing very well now. I've been doing a lot of other things, though, in the last few years. I helped lead coalitions in six states to raise the minimum wage, get it on the ballot, have it voted on. We raised the minimum wage in six states in this last election. We've set up a program to make college available. It's called College for Everyone, to make college available for kids who are willing to work when they were in college, and it's been enormously successful. I raised the money for that, helped put it in place. I've been around the country organizing, helping, not just me, helping organize thousands of workers into unions, which I think is important to strengthening the middle class. And I've been involved in a lot of work overseas. About half my time has been spent either overseas or working on issues overseas. Mm-hmm. For example, I co-chaired a task force for the Council on Foreign Relations on U.S.-Russia relations, and did humanitarian work in Africa with the International Rescue Committee. Mm-hmm. So I've been busy, but I didn't actually make a decision to, in understanding how serious that decision is, mm-hmm. And what's required, I didn't actually make a final decision until December.
But Americans all know, we've all been around this track before. We know that people like you start thinking very early about it. I've read that in pretty early in 2005, you were kind of making the presidential style rounds again already. I wish you'd take us back to that period. You were dealing with your wife's serious health issues, and we're glad that she made it through those so well. But how did you take on that defeat with John Kerry? And when did you say to yourself, you know what, I'm not going to take this. I'm going to put my toes back in the water, maybe my whole foot pretty quick here.
Well, it really is true that in the beginning, in the first few months after the election, we were completely consumed with Elizabeth's health. And it was after that got under control and looked like Elizabeth was doing well, that I really started doing the things that I've just been talking about, mm-hmm. Things that I think are important for the country. And they would have been important for me in serving the country no matter what I decided to do. But I was very open even back then in 2005, 2006, that I was seriously thinking about running for president. And I made the final decision this past December.
Was that the first time you'd taken that kind of defeat, that defeat with John Kerry? And did that sort of offend you, John Edwards doesn't get beaten?
Well, I'm very competitive by nature. I've got an ego like everyone else. I don't believe that is the driving force in why I want to be president of the United States. I honestly believe, this was the question for me internally, that this is the best way to serve my country. And there are voices in this country that are not heard, including the voices of the poor, to a large extent the voice of the middle class and working people, millions of people who don't have health care coverage. And I do want their voices to be heard. And I'm also driven by what I see as the huge challenges facing this country. How do we turn around the way America is viewed by the rest of the world so that we can lead in an upright and good way again? Mm. And how do we deal with these issues of health care and energy and so forth that we face here at home?
We're going to look at those. Your tone has famously changed. You're a lot tougher this time around. You seemed a very determined centrist, very determined to be seen as the positive candidate last time. Are you angry? Are you angrier? And why?
No. First of all, I'm running a very positive campaign this time, always will. It's the heart and soul of who I am as a human being. That will not change. It can't change. It's who I am as a person.
You said not so long ago George Bush has screwed up the values of this country. That's not the kind of comment I recall from you in the run-up to 2004.
Oh, no, I think I said things similar to that in 2004. A lot of times people look at me and I'm Southern and they listen to this voice and it seems like it's a very reassuring voice, and sometimes the words don't sound as powerful or as strong because of that. Or it's tough, I guess is the right word, because of that. I think what has happened, though, is a combination of my being more seasoned, more mature, having more depth, both from the work I've been doing here and overseas, and from the studying that I've been doing. And then secondly, I think that there's been changes in this country. There's been an evolution in America and the rest of the world that requires more substantial change. I think incremental, small baby steps on issues like Iraq and health care, they're not enough. I mean, we need real transformational change in this country, and that's why I'm sure we're going to talk about it.
Yes,
I've laid out a truly universal health care plan, talked mm-hmm. about my plan for Iraq, and talked about what we should be doing about things like energy use. Because I want people to know where I stand. I don't want there to be any question about that.
And we're going to look at exactly that. I just want to get the undergrowth cleared here a little bit, though. On the polls, we see In the headlines, we see an awful lot about Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator Barack Obama lately, not as much about John Edwards. But when I then I look at the polls here, this is a strategic vision poll from just last week in Iowa. It shows you leading with 24% over Hillary Clinton, 18% Barack Obama, 18%. A Zogby poll a little earlier, you neck and neck with Hillary Clinton. Let's see, South Carolina, Clinton 34, you 31. How do you read this sort of trio here? Why are Barack and Hillary getting the headlines? And where do you think you stand in the running at this point?
In the horse race?
Yes, sir.
I think in the horse race, which I hope is not what we're going to spend most of our time talking about, but in the horse race, we don't have a national primary. People get deceived sometimes by looking at national polls among Democrats. Whether I'm doing good or bad in those polls is really meaningless. What matters is how are you doing in the early primary states? Iowa comes first, Nevada comes second, New Hampshire third, South Carolina fourth. So the real issue is how strong are you in those states, because those states will play an enormous role in who the nominee will be, and a lot of people believe they will decide who the nominee will be. I think in every public poll in Iowa, I've been at the top. So I believe, based on everything I've seen, that I have a lead in Iowa right now, which is the first place we go. Seen no polling in Nevada, but I know from my relationships and the support that I have there that I'll be very, very strong in Nevada. New Hampshire's been very competitive among the top three, Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, and myself. And in South Carolina, I was born in South Carolina, won the South Carolina primary in 2004, and I think when voters get focused, that's a place that I should do very well.
Jennifer's calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Jennifer, you're on the air with John Edwards.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm calling to represent the middle class. I'm very frustrated because I don't think that we're being heard, because we can't compete with the interests of large companies, basically global companies. And I would like to know the senator's opinion on two things. The offshoring of American jobs to markets overseas that pay wages less than what McDonald's pays in the United States.
Yep.
Very hard for us to compete. Illegal workers coming in over the border and also decreasing the wages to that, to the point where Americans can't take jobs. They'll take them, but they can't survive on them and pay taxes. And global warming is a huge issue.
There's a lot right there, Jennifer. Thanks, John Edwards. There's the meat for you.
There's a lot there. Well, let's start with an issue that the first question Jennifer asked, which I think is a huge issue for America. We've had a growing wealth gap in this country. There is economic growth statistically. That economic growth is almost entirely at the top. Middle-class families have stagnant wage growth and increased costs for everything, from health care to gasoline to sending their kids to college, literally everything. And one of the factors in the stagnation of the middle class in this country, it's not the only one, but one of the factors is this whole question of globalization, trade, how America trades. And here's what I think about offshoring and the issue of trade. I think, first of all, we live in a global economy. We need to be honest and realistic about that. And politicians need to be honest about it. They need not just play on people's fears. We can't stop trade. Trade is inevitable. The question is, and nor should we, by the way, the question is how we trade. You hear a lot of debate about fair versus free trade. Smart trade is what America should be engaged in. And that means, and particularly in our bilateral trade agreements, we need environmental standards and labor standards, international standards, but they need to be standards that can be met by the countries that are involved.
Does that amount to protectionism? Some Democrats seem to almost be saying that now.
Yeah, I don't. Here's the problem. If you set the standards at such a level that they can't be met by the country you're trading with, they become meaningless. I mean, not meaningless. They are protectionist, in effect. The trade agreements become meaningless. Now, you have to set the standards at a level that the standards are achievable. But our trade agreements shouldn't be standardless, which is some of what we've done historically. And then the second component, and this is something that Jennifer would be concerned about, is America has to do more to fulfill the social contract that used to exist in this country. What used to be true is when people lost their jobs, either the country or their employer would be there for them. Well, that's just not true anymore. People are left out there by themselves, and America has to do much more to provide job training, education, interim health care, making sure that, communities that are devastated by trade get the kind of support that they need or, and are entitled to.
Are you talking about going back to the welfare society? Does that come back with John Edwards?
Nothing. It has nothing to do with the welfare society. Mm-hmm. It has to do with renewing the social contract that exists for people who have worked hard mm-hmm. and have lost their jobs through absolutely no fault of their own. Why? Until they get back on their feet again. Because all these folks want to go back to work. They want to find a job. They just need some hand. They need some help in order to make that transition. And America, as a country, it's important to us to help them make that transition.
What about the 10 million maybe illegal immigrants and workers Jennifer's talking about, and their impact on wages?
Yeah, Jennifer's not going to agree with what I think about this. I suspect. First of all, I think the evidence is very cloudy on the impact that illegal immigrants have had on wages in America. The studies that I've seen are very much this one and then that one. They reach different conclusions. I know I read one not long ago that was done at Princeton, and they're in conflict with one another. And
on whether or not they drive down American wages, you're saying?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. Mm-hmm. And here's what I think. I think that we can no longer sustain what's happening on our southern border. We have to be much better. Use of technology, resources, manpower in securing our southern border. I think that flow has to stop. I also think that for the millions of people who are here and who, except for coming here illegally, have been responsible and working hard, we shouldn't have a second class group of citizens in this country. And I think we ought to have comprehensive immigration reform to allow those folks to earn American citizenship. Now, I'd be pretty tough in making them earn it, but I think they have the right to earn it.
Are you lined up with President Bush on that?
Well, I think there's some differences between President Bush and me. I think they ought to actually be able to earn American citizenship, first of all. Second, I think that not some interim status.
Not guest work.
And second, I think they should pay a fine to recognize that they came here illegally. You know, we're a law-abiding society. We can't ignore the fact they came here illegally. And then secondly, and this is more controversial, I think they should learn to speak English. English is the language of commerce in the United States, and I think we can't require anyone to learn to speak English who comes here from another country, but if they're asking to be allowed to be American citizens, I think it's a reasonable requirement to ask them to learn to speak English.
So speak English or go back home, back to Mexico or wherever they've come from?
Speak English, or if you want the right to become an American citizen and you came here illegally, mm-hmm. we're going to give you that right, but one of the requirements is you have to learn to speak English.
Wow, that's interesting. And then a great big one, global warming. You've mentioned energy. What's the outline of your policy there?
It's a big issue.
Sure is.
Here's what I think. I think, first of all, we use 22 million barrels of oil a day. 12 million of them are imported. We are 4% of the world's population, emitting 25% of the world's greenhouse gases. Mm. We are not exactly a good example for the rest of the world. And it makes it impossible for us to have the credibility to go to developing countries like China, India, who are going to be absolutely necessary to deal with the issue of climate change. So I think energy usage and climate change are inextricably interwoven. And so you have to deal with both things comprehensively.
And you said Americans have to take some tough medicine here, not just fun, you said.
It won't. It won't work. I mean, what politicians love to talk about are clean alternative sources of energy, which are very important. They're, mm-hmm. they're an important piece of it, wind, solar, biofuels. But that alone will not do what needs to be done to get America off its addiction to oil. We're going to have to actually be willing to conserve, drive more fuel-efficient vehicles, conserve in energy use at home and in offices. We ought to ask Americans to be patriotic about something other than war. This is the place where Americans could show their patriotism, their love for their country, by doing what's necessary to make us stronger. And then finally, again, this is a little more controversial, but I believe it, so I'll say it. I think we need a national cap on carbon dioxide emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that cap should be ratcheted down over time, because if we don't start capping and reducing carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, we're going to get to the place on the curve, and mm-hmm. we're already way down mm-hmm. the road. that it becomes virtually impossible for us to bring about the changes that need to be that need to occur. And a 4 to 8 degree warming of the Earth over the next 75 years has potentially frightening consequences. I mean, migration of hundreds of thousands, millions of people, political upheaval, lack of food, lack of water. And this is not a problem for the future. This is an immediate, intense problem that we need to address right now.
And you don't think conservation is a deal killer with American voters anymore?
No, I don't. I think that, I'll give you an example that's unrelated. If you look at the way the government responded to New Orleans, it was a mess at every level, local, state, federal. But the American people were amazing. I mean, they volunteered, they went to New Orleans, mm-hmm. they took families into their homes outside New Orleans, they made contributions. I think when Americans believe that it's in the best interest of the United States of America, they are willing to sacrifice. The problem is no one has asked them to sacrifice. This president said to them after September 11th, go shopping. Mm. Well, I think America is prepared to take this much more seriously and get involved.
Let's take a call from Iowa. John Edwards is with us. Kay is calling from Colfax, Iowa. Kay, you're on the air with John Edwards.
Hi there.
Hi.
Happy to talk to you. I'm a Democrat from the Roosevelt area. I'm 85 years old. My first vote I cast was for Franklin D.
Wow.
I am upset about so many things. I have a young daughter in Kansas who's working in her head off for the Democratic Party. I want to see a cap put on the amount of money people can spend to campaign, because it's making the television companies really rich and everybody's making money off of it. But the mess, all that money they're spending could be spent on the poor people that don't have health care, that don't have food, that don't even give a darn whether they vote because they know it isn't going to do any good. And you have made me think maybe they can. And I think there ought to be a cap on what they can spend to do this and not start in September.
McKay, isn't that free speech, putting up all those ads on television?
What?
Isn't that free speech?
I believe in free speech. If the television company wants to give each candidate the same amount of money and let them have free speech, and that can be the television company's donation to the country.
Okay, we got it. Kay, thanks very much. In Colfax, Iowa, John Edwards, what do you say to that?
I say we ought to put Kay in charge of the way we finance campaigns in this country. She sounds like she's got good sense to me. I think that this money chase is unhealthy, and I'm not saying I don't want to be holier than thou. I don't want people to think, well, now he's pure about this. Everybody, every serious candidate running for the presidency is out there raising money every day. Every one of us. I have raised millions of dollars.
And haven't you already slipped the noose of public financing? Aren't you also one of those who said you're going to spend whatever it takes?
I think that basically every major candidate, anybody who has any chance of getting the nomination on either side, has already done that. Now, having said that, I am also I am as vocal an advocate as you will ever find. And when I am president of the United States, I will do everything in my power to convince America, and thereby force incumbent politicians, because I think that's the process. Incumbent politicians are favored by this system that we have now, because they can raise more money. The power of incumbency, the power of office, allows them to raise more money, so they're advantaged. It is bad for democracy. This is not should not the campaign for the presidency, which I'm involved in right now, should not be controlled by who knows the most rich people and who can raise the most money. That is not democracy.
But that's what's going on right now. How do you get the genie back in the bottle?
It's absolutely going on. We need a president of the United States who will say to the American people, this is important to you, because right now it's a low priority. It disgusts them, but they just don't pay much. They're more worried about their health care. They're more worried about the war in Iraq, understandably. But the problem is this way we finance campaigns dramatically affects all those other issues. And the solution to this... you know, I think McCain-Feingold did some good things. I worked on it, which is the campaign finance reform law. It did some good things. It did what it was intended to do. But the way to ultimately solve this problem is to have public financing of our campaigns. That's the way to solve it.
Stay on top of it. Kay, thanks for your call from Colfax, Iowa. Let's take a call from Gustavo in Boston. Hi, Gustavo. You're on the air.
Hi, Senator Edwards. I was calling because in 2004 you saw firsthand how these carefully choreographed smear campaigns like Swift Boat could destroy a campaign. And recently you saw the loud right-wing noise machine go after and try to destroy one of your low-level staffers.
These are the two bloggers who left the campaign.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And what I see is that I am a strong supporter of Senator Edwards. And I volunteered for you, met you in Iowa New Hampshire last year. But in any case, I see Hillary and Obama, when they get a hit, they punch back, and they punch back very hard. And I just wanted to know whether you were able to, and would your campaign be able to stand up to the stuff that comes out of that very carefully choreographed right-wing smear machine and their surrogates?
Gustavo, we've got it. John Edwards?
Yes. If anybody understands, you talk about the maturity and the toughness and the seasoning that comes with having been through a national campaign. This is one of the things we all learn. We all learn from the past, and we learn from mistakes. And that there is absolutely no doubt that if I am attacked personally, I will respond and respond strongly. What you have to be smart about is not the fact that you have to respond and be tough and go back in a really strong, powerful way. Doesn't mean you have to get in the ditch with pigs. I mean, we have important issues that are facing this country. How do we get out of Iraq? How do we change our energy and environmental policy? How do we make universal health care available to every? How do we make health care available to every single American? How do we strengthen the middle class?
But what have you learned from the Swift voting? What did you learn from that? You know, Terry McAuliffe, former Democratic Party boss, said the Kerry campaign was gun-shy, distracted, incompetent. You've got Kerry people off the record criticizing you for not having been tougher in that campaign yourself in going after Dick Cheney and even the president. You saw what happened to John Kerry around the Swift voting. What did you learn from that incident?
Well, first of all, I went back and looked myself at the things I said during the time. And I was I was extraordinarily tough, but that's not by way of defense. The answer to the question is, somebody hits you, you got to hit them back harder. It's just that simple. That's the way politics works, and you can't govern unless you get elected.
Is that in your nature?
I spent 20 years in courtrooms where it was me on one side and an army of lawyers representing these big multinational corporations that I was asked about a few minutes ago on the other side. Highly paid, highly financed, and prepared to do anything ethical that they could do, legal in a courtroom to win. And I promise you, I didn't have the track record of winning that I had by being a sweet guy in the courtroom.
So do you think, you say you don't want to get down in the ditch with pigs, but what do you expect in this election? If you get the nomination, do you think we're going to see that same kind of, you know, bare-knuckled or brass-knuckled brawl again?
Yeah, I think you'll see some of that. I think it depends a great deal on who the candidates are on each side. I would personally love to see the debate elevated and not be at that level.
John Edwards, if you'll humor us for just a minute, because it's the morning after the Oscars, and there was kind of an extraordinary moment there last night. I want to listen to something here and then get your response. This was Al Gore. Of course, he took home an Oscar last night for An Inconvenient Truth. He had a little fun up on the podium, almost talking about his future political plans.
Even though I honestly had not planned on doing this, I guess with a billion people watching, it says good a time as any. So, my fellow Americans, I'm going to take this opportunity right here and now to formally announce my intention.
Humor Oscar style last night. John Edwards, did you watch that? Where do you see Al Gore right now?
I did watch it. I was very proud of the vice president for winning this off, for what he's done on climate change and global warming, first of all. And I was rooting for him with everything I had to win the Oscar. So I was cheering in my hotel room alone watching it.
And what about the issue of seasoning? Talk about seasoning. Talk about losses. He's was in there a long time and took very high-profile ones. The question still comes up around Barack Obama, of course, and sometimes around yourself. You've done a lot in these years since 2004, but do you now have the experience, as Dick Cheney once said you didn't, to do this job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these are questions that anybody thinking about running for president should be asking themselves, but and examining in a really serious way. But The answer is yes. I have the battle scars to prove it, first of all, and I have been getting my hands dirty over the last several years. Even since the, first of all, you learn a lot from going through a intense national campaign. There's a maturity that comes with that you can't replicate any other way. There's no other way to get that kind of experience except to do it. And I know the difference between me as a candidate now and me as a candidate in the past. I haven't changed as a human being. You know, I have the same value system. I still want to see people in America have the kind of chances that I've had. But my depth, my maturity, my seasoning is different now. And I've been out there getting my hands dirty, you know, doing humanitarian work in Africa and working in New Orleans with 700 college kids who gave up their spring break to work and making college available to kids and raising a minimum wage. I hadn't been sitting around on my hands. I've been out doing stuff.
Let's go to Betty in Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Betty. You're on the air with John Edwards.
Hello. Mr. Edwards, I'm ready to elect you president. I was ready last time, so we'll see if we can get it done this time. So you're over the hump with me. I have one concern that I'd like you to reassure me on. I now see you, as of the last 4 years, as having become something of a Washington outsider. So reassure me that you're still in the loop, that you have connections, and you know the best people to hire to help you with your presidency, because the success of your presidency will be dependent on who you hire to help you.
John Edwards?
Well, let me say thank you first for your support, and I hope I see you. I'll be in Waterloo, Iowa in the beginning of March, and I hope you'll be able to come out. I'd love to see you when I'm there. I know Waterloo very well. The answer is I am, I think, much more of an outsider. I think that's a fair assessment, actually. I think it's a very healthy thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I don't want 500 insiders in Washington, D.C. to decide who the Democratic nominee for president is going to be. I want voters in Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina and subsequent states to decide who the nominee is going to be. I don't want a crowd of insiders deciding that. And I don't think they will decide, by the way.
But what if you win it? Are you connected enough to bring in the team to turn things around?
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, I have a whole group of people who have been with me and been very loyal over a long period of years, and they are terrific, terrific people who believe in me and, more importantly, believe in the cause. As I said to them when we started this, don't do this for me. Do it because of the country you want to live in, what kind of world you want to live in. And they are totally committed to the cause, and they are wonderful human beings, from very young people to those who've been with me for many years. And I'm very proud of them. And I think we, and many of them have been through, have done something that that a lot of the people who are working on other campaigns haven't done. They have not only been through an intense presidential campaign, they've been through it with me.
But when you look at the kind of people you need to bring in to fill a cabinet for your closest advisors and so on, who would a John Edwards team be? Would it be back to a Bill Clinton kind of team? You know, who's your crowd?
Oh, wait, I can tell you that I have already given great thought to one of the things that changes having been through this before, is I spent a lot of time in 2003, 2004, thinking about how to be a great candidate. Sometimes I was, sometimes I wasn't, but that was sort of my focus. What I spend my time thinking about now is what I want to do as President of the United States and how I will go about dealing with the very difficult day-to-day judgments that the President has to make. That's a maturity, and I have thought a great deal about who I would want to consider for each cabinet position, what group of people I would consider as potential vice presidential running mates, what strengths they bring, what weaknesses they bring. I promise you, I have thought through the entire process and how to put together a transition team once I'm elected president in the period from the election to being sworn into office.
There's a man who's been around the track. Sheila's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hey, Senator Edwards, I appreciate this opportunity to ask you a question about health care, because I've spent 40 years of my life working with people in financial services, and one of the really critical issues that I face working with primarily middle-income taxpayers is the lack of their ability to make decisions that affect their lives because of the issue of health insurance and just, the escalating cost of health care and escalating cost of education for their children. And, you know, these are issues that I would love to have you all talk about and really address, and I appreciate your attention to those.
Sheila, thanks. Healthcare, it's a big one. Hillary Clinton's got plans. Barack Obama's talking about universal health care. Yours may be the most detailed. What's different about your plan? What would you do with health care, John Edwards? And Sheila, thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm proud of the fact that I am the only candidate, Democrat or Republican, who's come out with a substantive, detailed, truly universal health care plan. No one else has. And I did not want to wait on this issue any more than I wanted to wait on the plan for withdrawing from Iraq. You know, I've been out there saying what I believe and what needs to be done. I think it's what a presidential candidate should be doing in order to lead. Here's what my plan does. It requires shared responsibility. Employers are required to cover their employees or pay into a fund. The government sets up health markets around the country. In each of those markets, there will be a group of private insurers and a government plan. It's basically a Medicare Plus. Mm. People can choose from those plans. Some people love the idea of single payer, and it has some huge advantages. And so if they like that, they will be able to choose a single payer plan, a Medicare Plus plan. And it's certainly possible that over time, this system could gravitate towards single payer, if that's the choice of individuals. Mm-hmm. In addition, it creates efficiencies that don't exist today, marketing power that doesn't exist, mandatory reduction of administrative costs, mandatory use of technology, electronic record keeping. The government subsidizes health care costs. The subsidies end at somewhere between $80,000 and $100,000, depending on some other factors of income. Low-income families are completely subsidized. Expands, for example, SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program.
And you said you will roll back tax cuts for households with incomes over $200,000 a year to pay for that.
My plan costs $90 to $120 billion a year, and it has to be paid for. And the way I do it is to roll back Bush's tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 a year. And I do want to say that if you listen, you have to be really careful when you listen to candidates debate this issue, because you're going to hear a lot of rhetoric about universal health care. Hold their feet to the fire. Make them tell you how they're going to do it, what the details of their plan are, and how they're going to pay for it. Because I suspect there may be some candidates, I don't know this, it may not happen, but there may be a candidate candidates who say, we can provide universal health care, and at the same time, we can eliminate the deficit, and we don't have to do anything to the tax system. I absolutely believe that is impossible. And I've spent an awful lot of time on this. Can I mention just one last thing?
Please, sure.
Just very briefly. There are two other things that are really important components of this health care plan, and they are, number one, it goes a long way to eliminating job lock, because if you have choose a plan in these health markets, you can, if you lose your job or quit your job or change jobs, you can take that health care with you. And, of course, depending on your income level, you will continue to be subsidized, and you could be fully subsidized as you make the transition. So it deals with this issue of job lock in a serious way. And then finally, there is serious cost containment mechanisms here, and it fills in the gaps that exist in our present healthcare system. Complete mental health parity. We treat mental health exactly the same way as physical health. There's a required ongoing preventative care, so we contain costs that way. Chronic care, long-term care is covered. So the huge deficiencies that exist in our present health care system are dealt with in a very direct way.
Do you think Republican Senate would ever let this through? Does actually making this a reality depend on not only maybe you winning the presidency, but having more than 60 Democratic votes in the Senate? You know what happened to Hillary Clinton? Al Gore also became careful on this. They essentially say, now let's go in baby steps, because it's just a political killer to put what looks like it could turn into single-payer universal care out there. You just get whacked in the end. Does this sound good? It may be the right thing, but does it end up, you know, leaving somebody on a slab?
No, I think that it's the reason that Paul Krugman, I hope, at the New York Times, who said Edwards gets it right in a column talking about this plan, talks about that very issue, among other things. And I think the reason this plan is doable is because it's not ideologically driven. There are people from across the partisan ideological spectrum who will find the idea of shared responsibility one that makes a great deal of sense. There will be a lot of people who believe in single payer who find this a very good plan because it could gravitate towards single payer but gives people choices to begin with. There's a responsible revenue stream for paying for it. And I think that there's a groundswell in America today for doing something about universal health care. I think we need to quit worrying about the political failures of the past and have the strength and the courage to not worry about polls and do what's right for the country. And this needs to be done. This and energy and all the other things we've talked about. These are transformational changes to make America what it's capable of being.
Sean's calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, John? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I got a question for you. I'm going to pose it to you. I'm a Democrat. My vote is yours for the taking. The one thing that my concern is that the GOP has tended to woo us in terms of national defense and security. I really haven't heard a plan from any Democrat that's and going to make me feel much safer than the way I feel right now. What will you do to make me vote for you in terms of national defense, the war in Iraq, and not putting us in a position worse than where we are now by pulling our troops out of Iraq?
Sean, thank you. John Edwards, our time is short. Could you start with Iraq, what you'll do with that, and then bring it to the wider global security picture, if you would?
I will. First of all, there is no military solution in Iraq. The Sunni are fighting the Shia. The Sunni are out of power now. They're unhappy about it. The Shia are in power, don't want to relinquish any of their power. That political dispute is at the heart of all the violence. You know, are the militias contributing? Yes. Foreign fighters, terrorists? Yes. But at the heart of it is this political dispute. They have to resolve that. We cannot force them to resolve it. More American troops will not change that. An escalation of the war is a mistake. What we want to do is shift the responsibility to the Sunni and the Shia to actually reach a political reconciliation.
How do you do it?
And the best way to do that is to start withdrawing American troops, which is why I think we should do that. Simultaneous with that withdrawal, we should be engaging not only our friends, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Saudis, but the Syrians and the Iranians, both of whom have a direct interest in a stable Iraq, because they don't want millions of refugees coming across their border. And in the case of Iran, they are Shia country in a Sunni-dominated Muslim world, so they don't want to see this thing spread into a
How fast a drawdown and how big, sir? When would U.S. troops start out and be out?
Very specifically, 40,000 to 50,000 out immediately from the north and south, a continued orderly redeployment out of Iraq over the next 12 months or so. Some of those troops would go into Kuwait. Some would go into Afghanistan, but the majority would come home because they deserve to come home. And I do believe that simultaneous with this effort or anything else that we were doing, the President of the United States has got to develop a plan for containment. I mean, we can't pretend this thing, because no one knows what's
containing conflict in Iraq if it goes really ballistic.
Correct. It would be irresponsible not to have a plan for containment.
And the wider picture, Vice President Cheney's in Pakistan today, putting the arm on President Musharraf there to try and crack down on al-Qaeda. What's your big global security picture, John Edwards?
Here's my picture. America cannot lead through raw power alone, and we are the only stabilizing force on the planet. Until and if the world sees us once again as not only strong, we have to maintain our strength, that's critical, but strong and a force for good, they will not follow us. And this is not a feel-good strategy. This is crucial to us, the world rallying around us when the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, tries to get a nuclear weapon, or Kim Jong-il's testing missiles or nuclear weapons. Whenever a crisis occurs, there needs to be a stabilizing point, and we have to be that stabilizing point. For that to be true, we're going to have to make it clear to the world, number one, that we believe and embrace diversity in the world, cultural faith diversity, ethnic diversity, and the President of the United States has to be seen as a good and decent human being who actually believes that. And then second, we have to take action to demonstrate our responsibility to humanity. I mean, there's an ongoing genocide. I'll just give you one example. Ongoing genocide in Sudan, in Western Sudan, in Darfur. Our country declared this a genocide a long time ago, and we've stood by and watched it continue. And if you see this through the eyes of the rest of the world, it makes absolutely no sense. We can't be the country of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. We have to be strong, but we have to be seen as a force for good and the good of humanity.
John Edwards, there's much more to hear, and I'm sure we will, but we're glad for the start with you this time today. Thank you very much for being with us. Good luck on the trail.
Thank you for having me.
Former U.S. Senator John Edwards, now a candidate for the president again in the Battle of 08. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.